The 100 Years' War. It's a Duguesclin period. The invasion of Castile collapses. In Bordeaux, John of Gaunt was oblivious to the travails of the exchequer at Westminster. He assumed that the money was on its way and played his cards with some skill while he waited for it to arrive. He persuaded his captains to be patient and managed to form some effective units from companies which were still able and willing to fight. With these, he made a show of force about the middle of February 1374 against the castles of French partisans within reach of Bordeaux. This brief campaign was brought to an end towards the end of February by a controversial agreement between the constable and the Duke of Anjou. The terms that were there was a truce covering the whole of southwestern theater, including Castile, until Whitsun, May the 21st, 1374. The two royal dukes promised to appear with their entire armies at their backs for an arranged battle near Moissac on Easter Monday, April the 3rd, on open ground and flat meadow at the confluence of the Tarn and the Garonne rivers. The truce was for different reasons in the interest of both sides. John of Gaunt, whose position was weaker than Louis of Anjou or Bertrand de Guesclin, realized a respite of more than a month to rest and resupply his army and resolve his financial problems, and nearly 3 months to complete his preparations for the invasion of Castile. The arranged battle, a traditional tool of English military diplomacy, is unlikely to have represented Anjou's preference. But he had virtually no troops under arms. The battle probably represented John of Gaunt's price for the truce. There was no doubt that Anjou took it seriously and believed that it could be won. His financial officials passed much of March negotiating loans and advances against the tax revenues of Languedoc. His marshals recruited troops throughout Languedoc. Louis' domains in Anjou and Maine were scoured for recruits. 1,000 men were hired from the Breton companies operating in the south and the center. The Duke of Burgundy promised to join him with several hundred more. The Count of Savoy came from beyond the Rhone. About 3,500 men had been retained for Anjou's army by the end of March, but the main force with which Anjou proposed to confront the English at Moissac was the large Castilian army of Henry of Trastamara, which was already assembled near the southern frontier of Navarre, waiting for the threatened English invasion. Anjou persuaded Henry to bring these men over the Pyrenees through the passes of Navarre. Charles of Navarre, faced with the threat of a Castilian invasion, reluctantly agreed to allow them through a small group of 300 at a time against the strict promises of good behavior and the delivery of suitable hostages. John of Gaunt's agreement with the Duke of Anjou immediately foundered on the objections of the King of France, who had not been consulted, strongly disapproved when he was told. The arranged battle was inconsistent with his firm policy of avoiding all major engagements with English armies. As for the truce, Charles consulted his counselors and jurists at the Parliament of Paris and pronounced it neither binding nor expedient, mainly on the ground that it was inconsistent with his treaty obligations to Castile. The Duke of Anjou must have learned of his brother's reaction about the middle of March. In the third week of March, John of Gaunt, accompanied by Thomas Felton, and some of the principal captains of his army traveled across the wastes of Landes to the southern march of the English duchy. In the cathedral of Dax on the Ardour, he met Gaston Phoebus, Count of Foix, and Charles, King of Navarre, the two great territorial princes of western Pyrenees whose support would be indispensable for any successful invasion of Castile. The meeting was also attended by uninvited guests. Three counselors of the Duke of Anjou, led by the Marquis de Cardillac, who appears on the behalf of their master. Their instructions were to ask Gaston Phoebus to use his good offices with John of Gaunt to have the arranged battle, now only a fortnight away, 14 days, cancelled, or at least postponed. They were also charged to discuss certain secret business with the Count of Foix and the King of Navarre, which can only have concerned the project of invading Castile. They appeared to have had some success in the matter of the battle, which was becoming an embarrassment to all parties. John of Gaunt must have begun to fear that he would be outnumbered at Moissac. Anjou, for his part, had certainly underestimated the time required to bring troops from Anjou and the Bourbonnais, and evidently had no conception of the logistical difficulties of bringing a Castilian army across the Pyrenees passes in early spring. So the battle was cancelled, and Louis of Anjou withdrew his request for Castilian reinforcements. The terms of the new agreement are obscure, but it is clear that in spite of the French king's repudiation of the truce, it was agreed to continue to observe it. On the projected invasion of Castile, however, Louis of Anjou's envoys achieved nothing. The terms of John of Gaunt's agreement with the King of Navarre have not survived, and it would be characteristic of Charles' ways if it were never recorded. But the outline was disclosed 4 years later by his chamberlain, Jacques Durieux, to the interrogators of the Châtelet prison in Paris. John of Gaunt was to be allowed to cross the Pyrenees passes and use Navarre as a base from which to enter Castile in return for his assistance in recovering Logorno and certain other border towns which Charles had been forced to restore to Henry of Trastamara in the previous year. John of Gaunt's treaty with the rich, powerful, and notoriously independent-minded Count of Foix was in some ways was an even more striking demonstration of the respect in which the English army was held by experienced observers in the region. In spite of its internal dissensions and battered condition, Gaston Phoebus opened his chest to lend the Duke money. He agreed to a marriage between his eldest son and John of Gaunt's daughter, Philippa, with a comparatively modest dowry. He proposed to put his powerful army at John of Gaunt's disposal for the campaign against Henry of Trastamara in return for a fee of 12,000 doblas, it's about £2,300, plus the wages of his men. The agreement records that the invasion of Castile was expected to begin within 2 months of Easter, in other words, late May, when the truce with the Duke of Anjou expired. As for the King of Aragon, he was formally uncommitted to John of Gaunt's cause. By the time that Gaunt's emissaries left Barcelona on March 10, 1374, Peter IV had made it reasonably clear that he was likely to support the English invasion. Issues in Barcelona had not been whether, but how, the strength of Peter's military contribution and the extent of his territorial rewards in eastern Castile. The delicate question of timing. All of Gaunt's diplomatic arrangements for invading Castile seemed to be falling into place, yet they fell apart within a week. John of Gaunt was back in Bordeaux by March the 26th. There he abruptly abandoned all of his plans for the campaigning in southern France and Spain and resolved to return at once with his army to England. The only possible explanation for this remarkable about-face is that he had now learned that funds to pay his army's wages were not, after all, on their way from England. Peter IV's ambassador was at the point of leaving for Bordeaux with his master's agreement to join in the invasion on Gaunt's terms if necessary. When the first reports of Gaunt's decision reached Barcelona, the Aragonese king declined to believe it and sent ambassadors on his pointless mission anyway. But within days it became obvious he was wasting his time. At Burgos, Henry of Trastamara stood down part of the army which he had recruited to meet the Lancastrian onslaught. Sometime after April the 8th, 1374, John of Gaunt boarded his ship in the Garonne. Sir Thomas Felton went with him, and apparently in order to recruit troops in England to strengthen the duchy's defenses. On April the 25th, they landed at Dartmouth. It would be a long time before England's reputation recovered from this humiliation. The Count of Foix abandoned his treaty with the Duke. The King of Navarre complained of betrayal and resigned himself to observe the hated treaty with Castile. His eldest son, the future Charles III, married Henry of Trastamara's daughter, Leonora, in the Castilian town of Soria in May of the following year. The King of Aragon canceled his embassy. Eventually, when threatened with imminent invasion from Castile, he too made terms with Henry of Trastamara, surrendering all the Castilian border fortresses which he had occupied since 1369. A month after Leonora's marriage to the heir of Navarre, Soria witnessed another royal wedding between the Castilian king's own heir and the daughter of the King of Aragon. These treaties reflected the growing military strength of Trastamara's Castile within the Iberian Peninsula. Just as the large dowry which Henry of Trastamara paid for his daughter's marriage signified his progressive financial recovery from the disasters of the Civil War. But the skin-deep recollections with Navarre and Aragon were agreeable to no one but Henry of Trastamara. Charles of Navarre dreamed of revenge. Peter IV made no bones about his own position. Writing to his official biographer, the Aragonese king said he never trusted Henry of Trastamara and had married his daughter to Henry's son only because the impoverishment of his kingdom left him with no choice. As for John of Gaunt, his Castilian projects were virtually abandoned. In the following year, the English government made a discreet approach to Henry of Trastamara through the King of Navarre, suggesting that the Duke might be prevailed upon to drop his claims in return for Castilian withdrawal from the French alliance and payments of debt owed by King Pedro to the Prince of Wales. No doubt these demands would have been negotiable if Henry had shown any interest, but he did not. He replied, according to Castilian sources, which tells us that while England and France remained at war, he would not abandon the French alliance for all the world. Now the sources for this, the Hundred Years' War, the Chronicles by Froissart, the Hundred Years' War by Perrois, the Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and the Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.